Back in the 80s, I went to a pastor's conference in California. It was a first-class production with several thousand pastors from all over the nation, and I think all over the world, really, in attendance. Awesome worship music lifted us to the throne of grace in a beautiful church sanctuary. Every detail of the conference was planned to the T, from the food served at the breaks to the goodie bags distributed to pastors. But the stars of the production, unquestionably, were the speakers. I got to hear some of the most famous preachers of that day, maybe any day. I got to hear Robert Schuller of Crystal Cathedral fame, who stepped from his limo and delivered one of the most inspiring sermons I've ever heard. It really, truly was, and I was fairly skeptical. Oral Roberts was there and delivered a message that was so moving. At the end of the message, he had the ushers pass the offering plates for his ministry, which I thought was a little over the top myself. A young Chicago mega pastor, Bill Hybels, brought a message that touched me deeply and renewed my sense of calling to ministry. And at that time in my life, that was kind of in question. Now, I don't remember the text of any of those messages, but I'm pretty sure at least one used a text from the letters of the Apostle Paul. And I wonder if Paul, had he been alive in the 80s in America, would he have been invited to speak at such an awesome conference? Or any conference since? Or any church in America today? Well, let's go to the text that I'm going to be speaking from today. And I think you'll see why I wonder. Back to 1 Corinthians. We've been preaching through 1 Corinthians since New Year's. And we're going to continue 1 Corinthians, in case you're wondering, up to the Sunday before Easter. And then we're going to make a switch. But for now, 1 Corinthians chapter 2, the first five verses. Apostle Paul. When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I came to you in weakness and fear and with much trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on men's wisdom, but on God's power. In contrast to the popular and polished preachers of the California Conference in the 80s, Sandy and I heard a different kind of speaker at a retreat down at the HEB Foundation Camp, a retreat for pastors and pastors' wives that we enjoyed very much. And the speaker was a college professor and author, Rodney Reeves. He had just come out with a new book in the fall. I bought it, read it. I've never heard of Rodney Reeves. Maybe you haven't either. I like the book. We signed up for the conference. He teaches New Testament at a small Baptist university in Missouri. Rodney came to Laity Lodge there at the HEB Foundation Camp to speak to a huge crowd of about, 20 pastors or so. He looked like a farmer. He was in jeans and it's a really laid-back kind of deal. He looked like a farmer to me. And I had two grandfathers who were farmers, so I know what farmers look like. He spoke in a conversational style that was humble and engaging. Rodney Reeves writes about the Apostle Paul in his book, which is on the spirituality of the Apostle Paul. And he says, to our way of thinking, Paul must have been a dynamic preacher, a powerful personality, but that wasn't the case. He trembled when he spoke, voice quivering uncontrollably from fear. Paul was the incarnation of weakness. I'm guessing that wasn't your picture of the great Apostle Paul. And you know, he was aware, Paul that is, of what the Corinthians, a church which he had planted, he was aware of what they thought of his preaching ability. In 2 Corinthians, another letter to the same people, chapter 10, verse 10, he says, for some say his letters are weighty and forceful, but in person he's unimpressive and his speaking amounts to nothing. You think he took that personally, maybe? The Corinthians preferred superb orators who not only delivered well-crafted speeches, but could also think on their feet, offering clever comebacks to silence the hecklers in the crowd. This was the primary means of entertainment in Corinth, in the Roman world. These sophist speakers came in and they had polished messages and they interacted with the crowd. It was a little like what you experience maybe at a comedy club. Very polished, very entertaining. Paul didn't do so well in the arena of motivational entertainment speaking. It makes you wonder what Paul would think of preaching in America today. It made me wonder what Paul would think of my preaching. We want our preachers to sound good. It helps if they look good. Handsome orators with entertaining messages. Obviously, we don't put much stock in that around here. It seems unlikely to me that he would have been invited to be the keynote speaker at a modern-day pastor's conference in America. In fact, it seems unlikely he would have received an invitation to speak at hardly any church. What amazes me, however, is how Paul responded to the criticism. I think I would have been tempted to defend myself. I mean, that's kind of the default setting when you get attacked, you get accused, you get criticized. You start defending yourself, right? I'm surprised. I think I would have said, hey, I'm not that bad. I've heard worse. Besides, I was good enough for you to come to faith in Christ to convince you of the gospel. But that's not what he did. Instead, he admitted his performance, preaching performance that is, was kind of pathetic. Which brings us to the first of three questions that I want us to consider in this text. Three questions that come to my mind as I meditate and studied on this text over the last couple of weeks. Question number one, just exactly what kind of preacher was Paul anyway? Well, he was humble. There's not a hint of self-promotion in Paul. In another letter, he refers to himself as the chief of sinners. And later in 1 Corinthians, he refers to himself as the least of the apostles. Paul was a weak preacher. He not only admits it, he seems to be glad of it. Why? Well, he wanted nothing of himself to get in the way or to be a distraction to the gospel message he was commissioned by God to bring to the world. He didn't come to promote himself. He didn't come to put on a show. He wanted people to get the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he was a bit disappointed to hear that the Corinthians were so enamored with gifted preachers. Their veneration of the messengers seemed only to distract them from the message of the gospel. What kind of preacher was Paul? He was humble. He was a humble preacher. Second, what kind of preacher was Paul? Well, he was a gospel-centered preacher. Although he did not come to Corinth with eloquent speaking ability, he did come with a message. Verse 2, he says, for I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I like the way Eugene Peterson translates that verse in the message. He says, I deliberately kept it plain and simple. First Jesus and who He is, then Jesus, and what he did. Jesus crucified. Paul may not have had the best delivery. Clearly he didn't. But he was certain he had the best message, the greatest message. He was quite satisfied to let the content of his message, the message of the gospel, stand or fall on its own merit. He didn't need to dress it up. He didn't need preaching tricks or sleight of hand. He didn't need funny stories to keep his listeners entertained. It was never about Paul, his success, his popularity, his press clippings. It was always about the message of the gospel. And he was determined to know one thing and one thing only. And that one thing only he was going to faithfully proclaim, and that was Jesus crucified. I can't tell you how many times early in my preaching, when on the way home after church, I would turn to my wife and say, "Well, that was horrible. That didn't help anybody. I was bored myself, and I was the one talking. That was awful. I don't know why I'm doing this. I should be delivering the mail." That was my repeated, "I should be delivering the mail. Just put letters in a box. I could do that." And she would turn to me in her loving way and say, "Honey, it's not about you." "Oh, yeah, that's right." Maybe the Spirit did something in that message because there was a scripture text, right? Yeah, there was. Right. Paul was humble. It was never about him. His message was gospel-centered every time, all the time. No self-help kind of stuff mixed in. It was the gospel. And third, he was cross-modeling. That doesn't flow too well, but I couldn't think of a better way to say it. In his life, he modeled the crucified Christ. You remember that word we had a couple of weeks ago that means crucified? That Greek word, estalromenon. And the key thing about it is not so much that it means crucified, is that it's the perfect participle. You remember that? I'm sure you do. It was a completed action that has consequence in the past, that has consequences in the present. And that's very important. So the crucifixion of Christ is more than an event that occurred in a specific time, in a specific place in the past. It is that, but it is more than that. It continues to have consequences in the present. The message of the cross continues to be exhibited in the lives of every Christ follower. Is that what you signed up for? That's what Paul talks about and preaches about. Paul's audience would not only hear the message of the cross, they would see it lived out in his life. And he lived with those folks for a year and a half. Asthenia, translated weakness in verse 3. Is the ordinary word, common word in Greek for just illness or some physical impairment. We know Paul had serious physical limitations. We're not sure exactly what they were. He says in Galatians 4:13, "It was because of an illness that I first preached the gospel to you." What? You mean Paul got sick? I mean, didn't that guy have enough faith to get healed? Evidently not. Or God had something else in mind. So most likely, Paul was referring to some observable physical impairment, condition, that people could see, maybe even poke fun at. Some speculate, and there's all kinds of speculations on what it was. Well, one of the most recent ones I've heard that I found kind of fascinating, really, is some speculate it was residual effects of head trauma, because he was suffered a stoning. At one point, people drag him out, throw him in a ditch, and a stoning means they drop big stones on you when you're thrown in a ditch. And so, and you can imagine what that would do. Well, that's interesting, because head trauma stays with you pretty much for life. I mean, you can recover So you wonder if that caused him to be speech impaired somewhat. Because he wasn't a good speaker. We don't know why. That was just interesting. But whatever it was, for him, there was a direct link between his own personal weakness and the gospel. Not his great strength, but his weakness and the gospel. At the heart of his preaching stood the weakness of God. That's the term he uses in the first chapter, verse 25. It's the story of the crucified Messiah. And his own weakness served as a further visible demonstration of the cross of Christ. So he gloried in his weakness. Not because he enjoyed bad health or whatever the impairment was, but because it was sure evidence that the power in him was of God and not of himself. Not only was he weak in appearance, he says he was fearful. He doesn't deny it or try to hide it. Paul comes to a place, but he's a veteran preacher and missionary guy. You mean to tell me he was nervous? I think he was. And fearful? He says he was. Maybe the preachers of today could use a little more fear and trembling and a little less showmanship and self-confidence. Maybe I could. When I first started preaching every Sunday, man, I was fearful, I assure you. It was a big challenge. I thought, I'm going to have to preach every single Sunday. What am I going to say? And I would get very nervous. And nerves affect people in different ways. For me, when I'm nervous, it comes right here. And every single Sunday, when I started preaching every single Sunday 16 years ago, I got sick on Sunday morning. Every single Sunday, I ate nothing for breakfast, nothing, trying to avoid the inevitable stomach cramps that were going to come. And sometimes they were quite painful. Sometimes it was so painful, I wasn't sure I was going to make it out of the bathroom. And it was just nerves. Eventually, that kind of went away. I still have reoccurring nightmares about forgetting to prepare a sermon. And the worship ends, and it's like, oh my gosh, how did I forget that? And I'll wake up in a sweat and get up and go check my notes and make sure I've got something ready. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe getting sick every single Sunday, maybe that was a good thing. The verb egenomenein in verse 3 can mean either I came to you, emphasizing that this is how he was when he arrived, or it could be translated I was with you, suggesting that he exhibited weakness in his ongoing relationship with them. I think it means the latter. The gospel must always supersede the messenger. Preachers and teachers and singers and servants of Christ must always point to Christ, not themselves. Paul was convinced that weak believers reveal the gospel better than anyone else. And the weakness in you is something God can work through far more than your great strengths. Just as Paul believed his weakness revealed God's power, so must we embrace our weaknesses and limitations as opportunities for the cross to be seen in us and the power of God to be demonstrated in us. It's not through your strength. It's not through your great skill. It's through your weakness. What kind of message is that? Do you know what that means? Well, what it means, I think, is that God doesn't need or He's not looking for another Christian celebrity superstar. He's looking for common men and women who will faithfully live out a cross-centered gospel every day in their everyday life to His glory. And God can work through that in incredible ways. And sometimes we get a glimpse of it, but often we just faithfully live that life out and trust that He works. According to Paul, your humble witness to the gospel, especially when you appear weak and ineffective to the world, accomplishes more for the kingdom than all the superstar preachers and musicians and athletes. I think that's what it means. Our second question. What does Paul mean by demonstration of the Spirit's power? The word translated demonstration means something like evidence or proof. In spite of Paul's visible weakness, his trembling fear, and his pathetic delivery, somehow the gospel came through. The truth of the gospel carried its own power. Gordon Fee, who writes a great commentary on 1 Corinthians, he says, "It's possible but not probable, given the context of weakness, that it reflects the signs and wonders. More likely, it refers to their actual conversion. The evidence lies with the Corinthians themselves and their own experience of the Spirit as they responded to the message of the gospel. The demonstration of the Spirit's power was people being transformed, people's lives being dramatically changed, these idol worshipers becoming worshipers of the living God." William Barclay, the old British commentator on Scripture, tells a story about a man who had been a reprobate and a drunkard. He says he was captured by Christ. And his workmates used to try to shake him up and say, "Surely a sensible man like you cannot believe in the miracles the Bible tells about. You cannot, for instance, believe that this Jesus of yours really turned water into wine." "Whether he turned water into wine or not," said the man, "I do not know. But in my house, I've seen him turn beer into furniture." You see what he's saying? The man's life had been changed. There is no greater demonstration of the power of God than a changed life. Some get caught up in the gifts of the Spirit and signs and wonders as if these things are like an end in themselves, or the primary means through which God works and the gospel is confirmed. And yes, certainly God sometimes works through these marvelous gifts. But give me the persecutor who's been transformed into an apostle, the slave ship captain transformed into the author of Amazing Grace. Give me the alcoholic transformed into a sober, loving father, the violent prison inmate transformed into a peacemaker, the adulterer transformed into a loving, faithful husband, and an arrogant elder brother converted into a broken, grateful follower of Christ. That's power. That's power of God that I have seen. That's power working in you. Which brings us to the third and final question. What does your faith rest on? There are a number of false foundations upon which people often rest their faith. What are some of these false foundations? The faith of your parents. When I was a youth pastor, there was a high school kid in my youth group, and she was getting pretty far astray from living the Christian life. And when I talked to her about that, I'll never forget what she said. "You don't have to worry about me. My dad's an elder." I thought, good luck. I hope that works for you. I don't think it is. You can have a mother who had a wonderful faith, or a grandmother who had a wonderful faith, or a father. That's not a firm foundation for your faith. Another false foundation is the faith of your friends. Well, it's true. We need community as people of faith. We walk together this path following Christ. But ultimately, in the end, your faith must be yours. Another one is your good works. Well, of course God accepts me. Look at all the good things that I do. It's not going to work. Or the preacher's persuasive preaching. And I've seen a lot of persuasive preaching in my day. Some are very good at whipping people up into an emotional frenzy. And that doesn't produce much, in my view. What does your faith rest on? Only the power of God revealed in the crucified Christ can save you and transform you from sinner to saint. And if you're thinking, not me, I can't change. I'll never change. This is what I am. Well, you're right about your powerlessness to change. But that's where the power of the living God comes in. Give your life and your future to the crucified Christ, and He has salvation for you, eternal life for you, peace for you, joy for you, the abundant life for you. And He's got a cross for you too. Most of us have received Christ, and we are believers. We've kind of already done that. We believe the cross-centered gospel that Paul preached and lived, but I suspect most of us kind of struggle living out that cross-centered life. We want God to heal us, to fix our troubles, spare us any loss and certainly any suffering. Well, there's evidence Paul struggled with that too. In 2 Corinthians, Paul writes about his thorn in the flesh. And we don't know what that was. It's probably a reference to this physical impairment that he had. We're not sure. But when you read the text there around that, it was demonic, it was embarrassing, it was debilitating, it was probably painful. And even though he says that it was given him to keep him humble, Paul also reveals that he asked God to remove this impairment from him. Not once, not twice, but three times. And you know what God's answer was? 2 Corinthians 12:9, part 1. But he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness." Evidently, Paul didn't care for that answer the first time or the second time because he kept praying. But eventually, his response to God's answer, "Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me." Perhaps you have your own thorn in the flesh, a physical limitation, a disability, or a long-term illness. Maybe you live with the searing pain of being abused as a child or a spouse. Or maybe you live with the consequences of some sin in your life committed long ago, or someone else's sin that affected you. Are you in a protracted battle against depression? Are you dealing with the challenge of a special needs child in your family? Or a child that has gone astray as an adult? Or an unbelieving spouse? Or a believing spouse who's hard to live with? Or maybe you're in a tough place with your job and it feels oppressive. And you've prayed, God, remove this from me. And maybe you prayed way more than three times for God to remove this thorn in the flesh in your own life. Could God be saying to you, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness? This weakness may be your opportunity to bear the cross of Christ, to testify to the grace and power of God in a way that others will see in you the crucified Christ. And that looks like, I think, continuing to love God and love others in spite of the suffering or the disappointment. It means refusing to make it about you and giving yourself for others. That's what Jesus did. That's what the cross was about. He kept on loving and forgiving and caring for the whole world right in the midst of the worst kind of suffering. So can you, when God's power is working in you. So I want to close today. I'm going to ask Steve and the worship team to come back, and we're going to sing. Actually, I don't really want to sing today at this point. What I want to do is, while Steve and the band comes and plays some music, hopefully, today. Did they go home? Okay, yeah, they're back here. All right, good. Look, I'm not into whipping people up into an emotional frenzy. I don't think I could do that even if I tried, but here's what I am into. The gospel, the cross-centered gospel. And so, Steve's going to play. And just, if you want to, I invite you to take this moment to come to the altar, if you like, and kneel and pray about the thorn in the flesh, the weakness of your life. But I want to encourage you, invite you to pray a different way. You've probably prayed a million times, God, take it away, take it away. Please take it away. Are you deaf? Take it away, take it away, take it away. Maybe it's time to hear God's answer. That is, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is perfected in your weakness. So I invite you to pray, Father, give me the faith and strength by your grace to receive whatever you have for me and to bear the cross that you give me to your glory. Now, that's a brave prayer. You don't have to come down here and kneel if you want. You can stay seated and say that prayer there. Or you can come, kneel, and pray. What are you carrying today? What weakness in your life can God work through in a shocking and powerful way?